what triggered this bizarre behavior.
Journey into the cold heart of Northern Darkness with Nordic Crimes.
That case became like a scene from a horror movie.
A new true crime documentary series that chilled the bone.
The hunger for killing is increasing in the course of these homicides.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Nordic Crimes is a part of the Acast family.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Before we get into the episode, I would like to warn everyone that this case does discuss the disappearance and murder of a small child. Although I always endeavour to avoid unnecessary disturbing detail, some people may find the content distressing. Listener discretion is advised. Hello. And welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. Today is part 5, and the final part for now, of the story of DeAndre Lane. Arrested, tried, and convicted for the murder of his daughter, Bianca Jones, it's a crime that he's always maintained he's innocent of.
Hey, how you doing, Mr. Lawrence?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you? Yeah, please call me Jack. Mr. Lawrence is far too formal. How are you, sir?
Yes, sir. I'm fine. There's so much going on yesterday with the game and stuff on, and people was just, I couldn't even get to the phone.
A couple of them went down again. So. That's okay, mate. No problem at all. I always realize.
Be available now.
Yeah. I was just sitting in my office just working away, so good timing. What's been happening in the wonderful DOC of Michigan?
Oh, my goodness. As always, nothing good.
Yeah.
it's just the environment is what it is. This is like a holding pen. You know, it's like you take people and you just house them there, just leave them to their own devices. You know,
yeah.
If you don't have the wherewithal to, or if you don't have it in you to make your situation and your circumstances better, it's not too much going on. I mean, they do a little programming here and there to try to make it seem like they're doing something, but overall. Yeah, this is revolving door nonsense.
So, are you in a two-man cell situation or a open bay, or what's your situation?
I guess two-man cell. You know what I'm saying? Me and a bunkie. Like single cells, they don't even really do that anymore, unless it's like a medical thing. Or they did have like one, I think probably one other spot that you had single mans, and they closed that mug down. So. Mostly it's either two-man or cube setting where you got like a pole barn, you know, like army barracks type stuff.
Yeah.
So,
and have you experienced both those situations, like a cell and also an open?
Oh, yeah. I've been in the single-man cell. I've been in the root having the bunkie, and I've been in the cube setting. And it's all garbage.
Yeah, right. Mostly. There's not one that you prefer?
I mean, I don't mind having a bunkie, you know what I'm saying, or just being in my own, you know, the cube setting, it's just people stacked on top of each other.
Yeah.
And it's just too many, like, they have, like, these cubes, and it's probably, like, 8 people in the cube, and there's just bunks on top of bunks, and in this small little space that's, wide open and it's open and it's congested at the same time.
Yeah. So in our previous episode, we ran through a list of witnesses that have been brought by the prosecution. His former partner at the time, Bianca's grandmother, her uncle, and so forth. One witness we are yet to speak about is one of DeAndre's other children, his daughter, who at the time of her sister's disappearance was just 8 years old. She would be with her father that morning in the car with baby Bianca as she was taken to school. She bravely gets up on the stand and answers questions from the prosecution and defence. Not an easy task for an adult, let alone a small child. However, there was one line of questioning and response from DeAndre's daughter that troubled me a lot. DeAndre's daughter is asked about an incident involving her own potty training and an incident involving her father, DeAndre. And this is what was said.
Today, Lane's 8-year-old daughter talked about the day she herself accidentally wet the bed and her father got mad.
I was screaming.
And what happened next?
And then they were in my mouth.
Who was holding them when they went in your mouth?
My dad.
What was your dad doing with the panties before they went in your mouth?
He was holding them.
Where was he holding them?
To my face.
And was he saying anything when he was holding the wet panties to your face?
No.
And did anything happen to your mouth?
It tore my underneath my tongue.
Of course, this is highly troubling. And I don't think anyone would argue that this is anything but abuse. However, of course, this is a platform for DeAndre to answer tough questions, so we spoke about it. So Shelley Butler was the mother of your 8-year-old, and we've spoken about the fact that your 8-year-old got up on the stand and she mentioned, she talked about a time where she says that you put some soiled underwear into her mouth, the force being so much that it tore part of the skin that's under the tongue. And her mother gets up on the stand and says that she sort of witnessed this tear in her daughter's mouth, and she asked her what had happened, and she told her that you'd put her soiled underwear in her mouth.
This is the thing, and this is why, like I said, when it comes to certain things, my lawyer, he just did a terrible job, because during the time we had this conversation, and when my daughter was saying what took place, I was like, that's not what happened. And my daughter even told her mother, that's not what happened. What happened is, I went in the room smelled like pee. I'm like, Alandra, what's going on? Did you pee in the bed? She like, no. So I get to looking around, and I find the underwear that she tried to hide and the clothes that she tried to hide. And what I did is I put them up to her nose. I said, smell this. You don't smell this pee on this? And she's like, yes. And I was like, so did you pee on yourself? She was like, yeah. And I like, why did you try to hide it? And she's like, because I didn't want to get in trouble. Now, that's as far as that situation went. And she even told her mother that that's as far as that situation went. And her mother even asked her, she said, why did you say your daddy put your stuff in your mouth then? And she was like, I don't know. Now, that wasn't the first time that my daughter had made up a story or lied about something to call her mother, to get her mother involved in the situation.
So what about what about this tear under the tongue that the mother says that she witnessed?
I told her, I was like, I don't know what happened with that. I didn't know anything about it. When we asked her about it, when her mother asked her about it, she told her, no, that's not what happened. And I didn't even witness the tear thing that they talked about. I'm like, what is y'all talking about?
You know, you're saying your daughter hid the underwear that she obviously wet herself or, you know, had an accident. She hid it because she didn't want to get in trouble. So obviously there's obviously a concern there with the kids regarding yourself and knowing that they're going to get in trouble if they have an accident.
The thing about it is that if you have a situation where you're saying have an accident or whatever, you know what I'm saying, and I'm like, okay, go stand in the corner. Don't nobody want to stand in the corner. Hey, you won't have dessert. Don't nobody want to have dessert. It's this thing to where it's like this mindset of like, all I'm doing is spanking my children. And it's not all about the spanking. It's about they don't want to be reprimanded, period. It's the same thing with schoolwork. You know, when she would go to school, if she got a good grade on something, she'll bring me the paper. If she got a bad grade on something, she'll hide it.
Yeah,
because she don't want to hear me talk about, you know, why you're not doing this or why you're not doing that. Go to your room. You can't watch TV. She don't want to do that. So she's going to hide it or try to cover it up. The thing about it is, especially when it came to my older daughter, her mother told me that she would be doing it because she would do the stuff with her mother's house. She was like, you got to watch out because she'll hide her stuff. You know what I'm saying? If she have an accident or something, she'll hide it. It is that other thing. So you got to be mindful of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, this wasn't stuff that was just going on in my home. It was going on at her mother's house as well. And I would tell her, like, I got to the point where, and this is the father that I am. It got to the point to where I would set my alarm for like 3:30 in the morning. And I would get up at 3:30 in the morning and go down and make sure, hey, get up, go use the bathroom. You know, stuff like this, nobody talks about this kind of stuff. Everything I do is demonized and made to seem like it's wrong because it's trying to fit the prosecution's narrative when all I'm doing is being a father.
The main evidence that would find DeAndre arrested in the first place would be that of a cadaver dog.
It turns out a dog is a key part of the prosecutor's case, and 7 Action News reporter Kimberly Craig tells us what the dog did and did not discover.
His name is Morse, and he and his handler, Martin Grime, work for the FBI. Morse, an English Springer Spaniel, is trained to detect the odor of human decomposition, and prosecutors say what Morse detected just a couple of days after Bianca Jones was reported kidnapped by her father is evidence that the toddler was killed.
Cadaver dogs are dogs who are trained to pick up the scent of human remains. Their work may seem similar to search and rescue dogs, but cadaver dogs play a distinctly different role. While the former is trained to pick up the general scent of humans, cadaver dogs specialize in detecting decomposing flesh. The first dog trained for human remains detection was Pearl, a yellow Labrador retriever, by Jim Suffolk of the New York State Police. Pearl started her career in 1974 and found the remains of a college student who'd been buried 4 feet deep that same year. Although cadaver dogs do help solve cases and bring closure to families, not many are actually employed by law enforcement. In the case of Bianca Jones, detectives would in fact fly over a handler and his dog from the UK. Detectives would say that the cadaver dog would hit on a number of spots. Firstly, in the bedroom where Bianca slept at DeAndre's home. A pillowcase, DeAndre's car, and baby Bianca's car seat.
The cadaver dog handler talked about how intricate this cadaver dog's, you know, senses were. And he said that the dog is trained to go to the source of the scent. So if you say the source of the scent, then that should be the spot where the scent is the strongest. And if you look at the transcripts of the trial, or if you look even watch the trial and look at the video of the cadaver dog handler's testimony, he says that the dog went to a closet and laid down at a closet.
Morse gave a continuous bark positive response in what I believe is the child's bedroom.
The dog is a small dog, but the girl's bunk beds is low to the ground. So if you're telling me that my child was deceased that night and she laid in the bed all that night deceased, then wouldn't the dog's general reaction, if it's supposed to go to the origin of a scent, be to go to the bed and not to the closet? But they say, oh, it's the general proximity. But that's not what he said. He said it's to go to the origin of the scent. Also, you have witness testimony that said that she was in the bathroom that morning, that she was in the living room sitting on the couch that morning. So if they're trying to say, like the prosecutor trying to say, oh, I was just puppeteering around a dead body, then the dog should have went to all these spots because the dog handler said that the scent is so transferable. He said if I touch a dead body and then I touch this piece of paper and I put the piece of paper in another room, that the dog will find the piece of paper. So therefore, why didn't the dog go to the dirty clothes hamper where her dirty clothes were from that night? Why didn't the dog go to the bathroom? Why didn't the dog go to the couch?
The dog, however, didn't give a positive response to clothing that was worn by Mr. Lane, did it?
No, sir.
So it's like, if this is what you're saying, and this is what your science is saying is how this works, then it should have went to all these spots. But then when you look at it, because of the fact that they didn't know exactly where in the bed my daughter was sleeping, they didn't have an area to point out, per se. So to say that, oh, the dog sat and barked at the closet and laid down at the closet, well, it was close to the bed, so it was in the proximity of the bed. So, yeah, now you don't have to really, you know what I'm saying, stand firm on what you're saying as far as this scent, this origin of the scent. And like I say, if you're saying that she was deceased that whole night, I changed her clothes that morning when I washed her up before she left out the house. Her clothes was in the dirty clothes hamper. Why didn't the dog go to the dirty clothes hamper? Why didn't the dog go to the couch? Why didn't the dog go to the bathroom? Like, all these, but they don't have anything, no reasoning behind all of this.
They said that the dog went straight to the car and there was, like, heaps of cars and the dog went straight to your car.
Mm-hmm. But this is the thing, though. Fact of the matter is, yeah, the dog went straight to the car, but this is the car that you knew I was in.
Grime testified that when police put Lane's car in a large warehouse of about 30 vehicles, the dog detected the odor of death on only one car.
He went underneath Mr. Lane's car, and then came out and gave a bark response next to the car, which is a positive response.
So, I mean, it's not a bug because they have had cadaver dog handlers in the past give their dog hints or, you know what I'm saying, direct their dog where to go. And this is why they changed the standard of the cadaver dog evidence that it has to be corroborated. It has to either be corroborated by DNA, forensic evidence, it has to be corroborated by eyewitness testimony, and it has to be corroborated by a confession. You don't have any of this stuff. So, like I said, you can't tell me that this is just standing alone. You can just say that this is true because you knew where this car was. You knew where, you'll say, you knew where the car seat was. You knew all this stuff. So it could have been easy. The dog could have been led to any one of these things. And in all those things that you were pointing to, there was no evidence of any kind of foul play.
I've just read something about the dogs again, something to do with the dogs hitting on the car seat and the blanket that were put into a different room than the car was in as well, they state.
Now, they say that the car seat was put in a different room. Now, check this out. The cadaver dog expert actually sends the dog into the building where the car seat was. The dog does not hit on the car seat. The police then take the car seat, put it in another room, opening up the packaging, and then the dog goes to the car seat. What kind of stuff is going on here?
So they had the car seat in just like a big building, did they?
Yeah, they had the car seat in a big building. It was in like one of those paper evidence bags.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And they sent the dog into the building. And when the dog went into the building, the dog couldn't find the car seat.
Didn't hit on it.
But then they placed it in another room, and then they opened the package and did whatever they did, and then the dog went straight to it.
Yeah, right.
So, like, when you have things like this going on, like, this is all suspicious activity. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, why? And then, for instance, my clothing. Why didn't the dog hit on my clothing?
They say the dog hit on Bianca's pillow.
The dog never hit on the pillow. The dog did not hit on the pillow. The dog did not hit on the bed. The dog did not hit on anything in the house in particular. The dog went straight to a closet and lay down at the closet.
So I did, in fact, reach out to the gentleman who was the handler of the dog that was brought over from the UK to work on this case to see if he would be willing to come on to obviously discuss the work of his dogs. But I am yet to, at this stage, get a response from his office. As you'll be aware from previous episodes, I love an expert on this show because, as I've stated, I'm not an expert in any of these fields, especially not on the workings of a cadaver dog. So I reached out to multiple organisations around the world, including here in Australia, who work with and train cadaver dogs to see if we could get an expert on to talk us through the process and the work of these dogs. Sadly, though, I am yet to get a response from any organisation that I have reached out to thus far.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now, although my efforts to speak with Mr. Grimes, the dog handler who is involved in this case, have fallen flat so far, he was, however, interviewed on a documentary which can be found on Netflix. It's called Exhibit A. It's a show where they investigate so-called science used within cases to show that there is still flaws within these types of evidence. And they focus on the case of DeAndre Lane. And talking to Mr. Grimes, he explains how the scent of a cadaver is very easily transferred from item to item.
If I pick a cadaver up with my hands, I touch my car door, my clothing, everything that comes into contact with that cadaver is a potential source of intelligence value if a trained dog can actually detect the owner.
But see, the thing about it is, like, even in the trial, like, the dog handler, he even told the jury, and the judge even told the jury, like, you can't convict alone. Like, the cadaver dog evidence cannot stand alone for this conviction. But when you tell somebody that, they're, you know what I'm saying, they're novice to the law. Like, they don't know what you mean it can't stand alone in the conviction. Like, what is that supposed to mean? Like, am I supposed to just get rid of the feelings that I have based on what I heard? But even him saying it, he's like, according to the standard that the cadaver dog handler is supposed to operate out of, a response without corroborative evidence is deemed negative. So in the true essence of the training of these dogs, because there was no corroboration for the dog's response, it was to be deemed a negative hit. But the prosecution and the cadaver dog handler used the term false positive, saying it's something. Like, and then when you use that term, when you say negative and then you say false positive, these two terms are different and have different connotations.
Behind. Of course, yeah.
Now, the handbook says it's to be deemed a negative response, but they get the prosecution and the handler using the term false positive. When you say false positive, it makes the person believe, like, okay, it's something there, but we don't know what's there. But it's positive for something. You know what I'm saying? If you say negative, then that means, okay, there was nothing there.
So when you say it had nothing to corroborate what the dog had found, do you mean there was literally no other evidence bar what the dog had signaled on?
No other evidence. No other evidence whatsoever.
Again, what DeAndre's saying here is true. Basically, for the dog's response to be deemed a positive response, there must be something found where the dog is indicating. But the police and investigators never found anything. No DNA, no blood, no hair, fingernails, nothing whatsoever.
She made the statement of saying, I beat her bloody. Like, where's all this blood at then?
They apparently found one speck of blood on her pillow.
They said the forensic examiner said that there was a spot on the pillow that had a slight amount of blood mixed in with saliva that could have came after she brushed her teeth, that could have came from a cough. They was like, it wasn't an exorbitant amount of blood. And it wasn't even seen with the human eye. This is what they detected after they did their forensic analysis of the pillow. So it wasn't like it was just like a big old bloody spot, or not even a tiny bloody spot. This was something that they detected after they did their breakdown analysis of what they saw. She's like, it looked like a mucousy saliva type spot, and there was traces of blood in the mucousy saliva. So it's like, you know, but you listen to the prosecution once again, deep bloody. Here's another thing. When they did the forensic analysis of the actual paddle, no blood on the paddle. You saying I beat somebody bloody with this thing that you call it a weapon. You said I beat them bloody with it, but there's no blood on it. See, I remember when she was in the courtroom, she slammed it up against the table like, bow, bow. And it's like, she's like, look at it.
When he took this stick and he beat that baby, and then he beat that baby till she was lifeless and bleeding, and he wasn't man enough to face what he did.
And my thing is like, okay, if that's really what you said happened, like I said, there would be blood everywhere.
And quickly returning to the show on Netflix called Exhibit A, where they spoke with the dog handler involved in this case, Mr. Grimes, this is how he summarised the work of his dogs.
There's a lot of people who turn and say, no one should ever be convicted on the say-so of a dog. I think everyone agrees to that. But it doesn't matter what I say. I can turn and say, my dog responded there. What's your dog trained to respond to human decomposition? Yeah? I will always believe my dog's right, otherwise there's no point in me doing this job. I will always say I think my dog's right, unless he was absolutely wrong, yeah, but that's unlikely. But I can't go into court and say there was a dead body there. That's up to somebody else to say.
Something else that is quite interesting is that this cadaver dog was not the only dog that had been working on this case. There was another dog and dog handler from the local police department who had been drafted in to initially help with the search of baby Bianca. The prosecution, though, did not call this police officer as a witness. The defence, however, did. Why? Well, when DeAndre was first spoken to by police, he described a man wielding a gun and wearing a dark black balaclava. This police dog and his handler that was tracking baby Bianca discovered just a block away from where DeAndre's car was discovered a discarded black balaclava. I think one of the biggest issues people have with this case and DeAndre's story is the fact that he didn't call 911 when this event first happened. We've even had it in the OMR Facebook group, people struggling to understand why he wouldn't call 911 straight away. Well, DeAndre would make a call straight after this event had taken place. However, it wasn't to 911, it was to his roommate.
As far as me not calling the police, I tried to make a phone call, which is evident by the call that wound up being made.
You did try and call the police after it happened?
I did try to call the police, but I wound up not dialing the right number. The number that wound up going through was to my roommate, because that was the person who I had called. It's like a automatic, like, you know how you have things programmed into your phone? And it's like an automatic dial.
Like a speed dial.
I didn't know, you know what I'm saying? And I didn't know who I was talking to. I didn't even realize that I made that call until later on when they told me, like, no, you made this phone call.
Yeah, right. So you called them from where it happened, thinking that you were calling the police, but you accidentally called your roommate.
I have no idea where I was when I called. This is what I'm saying. Like, I'm not even cognizant of making the call. I know that the call was made because they told me I made this call. I can't tell you what happened from this point to this point, and this witness is saying, oh yeah, we spent 10-15 minutes trying to calm him down when he got to the house. I don't even recall the calming down. I don't recall the phone call. I recall the situation happening, and then I recall looking into my daughter's mother's face on her porch with police being all around. Everything else, I'm filling in the blanks based upon what I'm being told. Like, it's so easy for people to say, oh, in that situation, I would do this. In that situation, I would do that. But you don't know until you're in that situation.
So DeAndre says he doesn't remember making this phone call, but we know that he did. So he had tried to call someone after this event. In fact, his roommate would get up on the stand and testify to this phone call coming to her mobile phone. She says that she didn't really have a conversation with him. All that she heard was him screaming and yelling for help.
This woman the court asked us not to identify was living with DeAndre Lane at the time investigators believe Lane killed his 2-year-old daughter Bianca and covered up her death by claiming she was taken during a carjacking. And it appears she was the first one Lane called after that reported carjacking and not police.
I heard pleading, crying, someone help me, please help me. Somebody took my baby. he kept repeating it over. I was calling, like, what's wrong? What's wrong? How can I help you? But there was no answer. It just was constant.
The biggest bombshell for this case would come when a former Detroit police officer, Nikki Gibbs, would get up on the stand for the defense and claim that she had seen baby Bianca 8 days after DeAndre was supposed to have killed his little girl. Nikki Gibbs says she was called out to an address on a domestic dispute call. When she arrives, she notices a little girl at the home. She recalls the little girl's distinctive large bushy eyebrows, a distinctive feature that also belonged to Bianca Jones. Officer Gibbs says that when she inquires what the child's name is, the lady at the house stumbles over the baby's name and the pronunciation, which she thinks seems odd. The following day, Officer Gibbs is at her desk at the station when she spots a picture of baby Bianca on her computer.
I kind of looked again. I said, wait a minute. In hindsight, I said, that's the little girl that was in that house.
And so, you're comparing the little girl to whom?
This photo on my homepage on my computer.
And that photo was of whom?
Bianca Jones.
Now, she says she does speak with some fellow officers to say she thinks she's seen baby Bianca. But it would take her a couple of days before she would actually go to the team investigating this incident. She says that when she tells Homicide about what she'd seen, she is told that the child is dead and they have her father arrested for the crime and it would never be followed up on.
She specifically said, I know I'm saying without a reasonable doubt, shadow of a doubt, that that was the little girl. She's like, she went to her superiors and told them that she saw this girl. And her superiors told her, we'll get with the lead detective. And the lead detective said, well, no, we already had the father pinned for this. The cadaver dogs, we had the cadaver dogs, and they alerted on the car and at the house. So we're going to go with that.
Nikki Gibbs wouldn't be the only one to claim to have seen baby Bianca alive after her supposed murder. Private investigator Michael Salisbury was a court-appointed PI hired to help DeAndre's defence team. He would follow up on Officer Gibbs's tip. However, this was 9 months after she had now been missing. He says, though, when he arrives at the property, he immediately recognises baby Bianca. He said she had been now dressed as a boy, and more bizarrely, the child's eyebrows had been shaved off. Obviously, Mr. Salisbury is not a cop, so has no power to get involved there and then, but says he contacts DeAndre's attorney straight away, who then calls police. However, the information is not acted on straight away, and by the time the police do follow up on the information, no child is found at the address.
Right, he recognized it. They tried to, like, he said they, like, cut her hair or shave her eyebrows down to try to change her, you know what I'm saying? They tried to change her, the way she looked, but he's like, he knew for sure it was her. He did make a statement. He did talk to the police about what he saw. Once again, expressing the fact, he said that he saw my daughter at this house. They tried to disguise, disguise her and had her dressed up like a little boy. And like I said, by the time the police say they got there, they didn't see there was no child at the house, or that child wasn't at the house. There was only one child there. But the same thing is, like, both people are saying that the child that they say that was there, that's not the child that they saw.
Yeah.
So, like, to me, that's real suspicious, and for them not to investigate it further was just basically, like, the detective said there was a charge of the case. She's like, we basically have the father. So there was really not a need for them to, or an incentive for them to go and check all these different leads that they were getting, even if they came from a Detroit police officer.
Police have said that they cannot explain these sightings, but have said they are either mistaken identities or complete fabrications. Another thing that DeAndre seems to cop a lot of flack for online is the fact that he did not testify in his own trial. A lot of people see this as a guilty person not wanting to answer difficult questions. However, you will know from listening to this show, this happens all the time. Defendants being told by their attorneys, don't get up. And it seems in this case, it is exactly the same story.
Now, this is the situation with that. I wanted to testify, at my trial. But I had family members, and then I had my lawyer, and my lawyer was like, you know, it's better if I didn't. He was like, he said that the first thing that they, he's like, right now they don't have any evidence on you. We've proven that they don't have any evidence. He said, me getting up there would only hurt me. He said, because the first thing that they're going to try to do is they're going to try to make me angry. He's like, they're going to say things, and you're going to get upset, and then they're going to paint this picture like, see, he's the angry black man. And he was like, he didn't want me to go through that. I told him that I wanted to. So I was like, but I want to. Like, what do we got to do? Prepare me for it. You know what I'm saying? But at the same time, I did understand what he was talking about. And then I talked to my family about it. And they were like, you know, your lawyer, he knows what's best. And if that's what he feels, then just listen to your attorney. And at that time, you know, when it came to my attorney, I was like, you know, he's supposed to be the one fighting for me. So I listened to what my attorney said. And today, to this day, that's one of the things that I regret, that I didn't testify.
Yeah, I mean, I hear it a lot. There's a lot of people in your situation that don't testify, that wanted to testify, and they wish they had testified. You know, I've spoken to attorneys on this matter. You know, there's an attorney that joins me on this show to talk about the cases that we discuss. And he said to me in the past, you know, as a defense attorney, he's a defense attorney. He said, you know, you really don't ever put your client on the stand unless you actually don't believe they're going to win the case. If you think that, you know, it's not looking great, then you put them on the stand because you've really got nothing else to lose, so to speak. But he said in the past that it can do a lot more harm than good having your, you know, your client on the stand. You know, and I can see it from both sides. I can see it as a frustration for someone like yourself wanting to give your side of the story. You know, you spend weeks sitting there listening to other people tell their side of the story, and you know, people talking about you, and you really not being out. You can't say a word. You know, just sit there, shut up, and let everyone else do the talking, while your sort of life and your fate is being discussed, and you can't say a word. So I can understand how that would be frustrating, and how you'd want to get up and, you know, dispute everything that had been said about you, basically.
Right. And the thing about it is, like, I didn't have any character witnesses or anything like that. I told my attorney that I have character witnesses that he can call, and he was like, you know, we don't really need all that. We kind of got it under control. They haven't proved anything. And that was one of the main reasons why I also wanted to take the stand, is because I'm like you said, you got these people talking about me, and none of these people don't know me. And then these people that are getting up on the stand, like, I'm the one who knows what they're saying is true or not. And I want to defend myself. I want to tell my side of the story, what actually happened. And because I didn't have anybody else up there to defend my character and things like that, I wanted to defend my own character, you know. And I like I said, to this day, I feel like I should have. But, I mean, hindsight is 20/20. So
yeah, of course.
We can't go back. We can only go forward.
How long did the jury take to deliberate on this one?
It was about 2 days. The second day they came back, they actually had asked for more time because they wanted to go over different transcripts, because my nephew, when he testified, the jury actually came back on the second day and they asked for my nephew's transcripts. They wanted to read over what he said. And the judge basically told them that it would take too long to get those transcripts, and unless they wanted to basically be sequestered while they got them together, that they should go in there and figure out through their collective memory what they actually remember. And in the law library, I realized that the judge can actually do this. They can actually, they can't flat out deny the jury's request for a transcript. But however, as long as the judge doesn't say no, but the judge can deter, make like statements to deter them from wanting to get said transcripts. And that to me is some bull crap. Because if you have a person's life on the line, and if they sit up here and say, hey, to come to a, you know, say concise decision, we need this person's testimony, then there should be no reason why the judge should not have furnished them that testimony in a transcript. Like, you have stenographers and recorders there for that purpose. But the judge literally told them, oh, it would take us about a week to get that information. So, you know, we would have to have you guys come back for the next week. And who wants to be sitting up in there for a week? It's like you basically deterring them from wanting this information. 2 days, and then they came back with their verdict. But I felt like that was, like, totally prejudicial when I read it. Like I said, I was in the law library, and I read this stuff, and it actually happens all the time.
DeAndre Lane's trial comes to a close, and of course, the verdict in this case is yet again big news in Detroit.
Based on the number of people that are here, we are going to, I'm going to request that there not be any sounds, clapping, crying, etc. The jury has been here very patiently. They've listened to the evidence, and now they've rendered a decision. And whether or not people agree or disagree, it has to be respected. So I'm asking those individuals who are present in the court that please don't make any sound when this verdict is read. After the verdict is read, Madam Clerk will then poll the jury. You may proceed at this time, Madam Clerk.
At this time, would a fourth person please rise? State your seat number for the record.
Number 14.
Madam Fourperson, how do you find a defendant, DeAndre Lewis Lane, as the count one homicide felony murder as to Bianca Lily Jones or the lesser?
Guilty.
Guilty.
Guilty of homicide felony murder as to Bianca Lily Jones.
As to count two, child abuse first degree.
Guilty. Guilty as child abuse first degree.
I've watched the moment. You can watch the moment. You know, it's obviously was publicized as well. But talk me through that situation and that moment of them coming back.
It was like, there was like, just like the world had just swallowed me up and crushed me. This is one of the most horrific feelings I've ever experienced.
DeAndre's sentencing would also, again, make headlines, but not just because of his sentence, but also because of his run-in with the judge in the case.
When she died, you had to devise a plan, a way to escape what you had done. You carried her around and controlled her dead body like a rag doll.
As Lane left the court, he called the judge a liar.
The court is going to sentence you, excuse me, sir, to no less than 11, no more than 30 years in prison.
I know you're a liar, Bond.
Bring him back out here. So as a result, no, excuse me, don't address me as Vonda. Take him out of here. Take him out. Take him out.
Obviously, when you're being sentenced, you were facing away from the judge during sentencing. A lot is made about that you weren't looking at the judge during sentencing. Was that a decision that you made, that you were, it was sort of almost like a protest in a sense, I suppose?
What actually happened is I had my niece, who I practically raised.
You have 1 minute remaining.
I had my niece, who I practically raised, my god sister and other family members in the courtroom, and they were crying. And I was trying to calm them down. And
right.
I was letting them know, like, this is not the end. Don't let them see you like this. Stay strong. I wasn't, like, the judge, she was doing what she was going to do. I was concerned about my loved ones.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And it was not in a protest to the judge or anything like that. The judge, when she addressed me, and using certain terms and making certain statements towards me, that's when I kind of went at the judge. And I didn't even disrespect her. I called her by her name. You know, I did say she was a liar, because there were things that went on during court, during the trial, where she would say one thing when the cameras were off, and then she would say something totally different when the cameras were on. And I wish there was somebody there recording like 24/7 to see how she put on this act and this face, this facade for the cameras.
Judge Vonda would actually do an interview regarding the case of baby Bianca after her retirement. She says that although surprised about the verdict due to there being no body found in this case, she believes that the jury made the right decision.
Nobody ever saw baby Bianca killed. Nobody ever recovered the body. This is what we call circumstantial evidence. I was very surprised. This is probably the only case that I've had as a judge or as a prosecutor, which is in excess of 26 years, combined, where there was a conviction that I knew of or that I was involved in without a body.
Thank you. To add another twist to this story, after DeAndre Lane is found guilty, his attorney from trial, Terry Johnson, says that he uncovers information that shows that the home in which Bianca was seen multiple times, once by Officer Nikki Gibbs and the second time by the PI, was owned by a lady named Patrice Hall. Patrice Hall, he says, is a relative of Benica Jones, the mother of baby Bianca. Benica Jones was questioned about this by Crime Watch Daily, and she states that she knows no Patrice Hall and is not sure who Patrice Hall is. Crime Watch Daily did make attempts to contact Patrice Hall. They in fact went to the property, but this house has since been sold. You know, there's lots of stuff online, as there is, people saying that, you know, she's not dead, she's out there somewhere. You know, there's claims that have been made that your former partner could have been involved in the kidnap of sorts, possibly even your mother-in-law involved in organising this. It has been mentioned in a number of different places I've spotted. Have you been asked about that?
The situation with Benica's mother, you know what I'm saying, Bianca's grandmother, there have been things said about that situation. There have been things said about my ex and her trying to... my thing is this, when it comes to a lot of those things, you know, I strive not to feed off into it because I don't have any evidence to prove it. You know, I know that Benica's mother did not like me. Benica's mother, you know what I'm saying, even with her coming to court and saying the things that she said, she lied on the stand when she said she had my daughter every week, almost every weekend. My daughter was 2. And she probably had my daughter one time her whole life. But she got on the stand and shed her fake tears and tried to gain sympathy from the crowd, and you know, and she put on this whole little theatrical act. And it's like, what would you do that for? When they were out looking and they were trying to gain evidence and things of that nature and find her, where were you at? Like, nobody ever came and talked to me and asked me any questions. It was always just accusations. You know, like, that stuff is weird to me. They said that the lady that they saw her, that Officer Gibbs saw Bianca at the lady's house, they said that lady has ties to her family. That's weird to me. However, the fact of the matter is that I don't have any proof of all this stuff. So I try to just, like, stay away from it.
Sure.
I try to not even indulge in it. You know, if something comes up and there shows proof, that's when I'll be like, okay, bam. I feel like just like people have taken accusations against me and ran with it, I don't want to put anybody else in that predicament.
You have 1 minute remaining.
This is the story of DeAndre Lane so far. And as always, we will stay across his story and bring you any updates as we get them. And of course, if you have any questions for DeAndre, or in fact any of the men and women that I speak to, and you would like them answered, don't forget to jump onto the OMR Facebook group and ask. DeAndre Lane's case was very public, with many journalists covering the story. Journalists whose job it is each day to report on news from the outside. Coming up, I speak to a journalist reporting on stories from behind prison walls.
This is Global Tellink. You have a prepaid call from...
Juan Haynes.
An incarcerated individual at San Quentin Rehabilitation Center.
Juan Haynes is a former bank robber who was sentenced to 88 years to life for his crimes. Crimes that he takes full responsibility for. But it wouldn't be until he found his way to one of America's most infamous prisons that he would find his true calling in life.
And you have to realize, you know, I'm into criminal thinking and everything like that. And so when I get to San Quentin, I don't even want to be here.
Next time on 1 Minute Remaining. 1 Minute Remaining is a Mashed Pumpkin production, created, hosted, and produced by Jack Lawrence. Audio and sound design by Jack Lawrence and Dom Evans of Earsay.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.